Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Maher, and I'll be your host for today's forum. The Hinckley Institute of Politics was established in 1965 under the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Hinckley Institute strives to teach students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers internships to students of all majors here locally, in Washington, D.C., and in 35 nations around the globe. Hinckley also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences in D.C., and over $400,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website, hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The lecture today is sponsored by the Tanner Human Rights Center, along with the Peace Advocacy Coalition. The Tanner Center is dedicated to providing University of Utah students, faculty, and the broader community with the inspiration and education needed to become advocates for peace, nonviolence, and human rights. The center seeks to provide avenues for the open discussion of important issues dividing the community, the nation, and the world. The Peace Advocacy Coalition is a group of independent peace advocates from various educational institutions and activist groups based along the Wasatch Front in Utah. In order to promote awareness, knowledge, and discussion, the PAC hosts an interesting series of guest lectures on the subject of peace each year. Thomas Drake worked in intelligence capacities for both the U.S. Navy and the U.S. Air Force throughout the 1970s and 80s. In 2001, Drake began full-time work with the NSA. Soon after beginning his work there, Drake raised concerns about the NSA methods and that were inefficient and wasteful, and also, in his view, unnecessary and intrusive. Frustrated in attempting to press these issues internally, Drake presented unclassified material to a journalist at the Baltimore Sun detailing these issues. After the publication of articles based on this material, Drake was indicted under the Espionage Act. Drake refused to strike a deal and fought the charges, and all the charges were dropped against him. In 2001, Drake was awarded the Redenor Prize, which honors the acts of truth-telling that protect the public interest, promote social justice, or illuminate a more just vision of society. Today he will speak on the use of the topic of the NSA and our constitutional rights. Please join me in welcoming Drake.
Well, it's a distinct pleasure to be here, and you know the topic that I'm going to discuss with you, I want to leave some time at the end for Q&A, is quite serious and sobering. But it's important to give you just a little bit of background in terms of me to provide a little bit of context. I actually grew up in Texas and Vermont, and both those states were republics before they became part of the Union. And when I was growing up in Vermont, one of the highlights of the year was the Vermont town meeting. It was democracy in action. I lived in a town of about 600 people, and that was the one day of the year the school was closed, and all the townspeople would come to the schoolhouse and meet. And Fred Cooper, who was one of the local farmers, who you'd hardly understand even if you lived in Vermont, because he had a very, very thick Vermont drawl, and half the time people wondered how he scratched out a living with his farm, because he only had a few cows, and most time you'd see Fred driving around in his car, pickup truck. Well, Fred was the conscience of the town. Fred was the truth teller. Fred was the whistleblower. Fred was the town crier. Fred was the one that held up the mirror. And even if you didn't agree with Fred, or if you agreed with Fred, or anywhere in between, you were compelled to listen to him, because everything that Fred said was in the best interests of the town. And if you didn't accept what Fred said, you did so at your own peril, because guess what? He would remind you at the next town meeting the following year. Fred normally would speak for somewhere between, for a Vermonter, this is an extraordinarily long time, any from a half hour to 40 minutes, and it was a monologue. And he would simply catalog all the goods and the bads and everything in between that he had seen in the town as he went to and fro over the previous year. He's holding up the mirror. I remember it because there were things that Fred would point out about what was going on in the town. He would remind people of the commitments they had made the previous year. He would talk about what was wrong. He also would acknowledge what was right or what needed further work. The one thing he did not do was ignore him. I speak of Fred Cooper because for me, Fred Cooper, a very irascible, very difficult to get along with character in my growing up in my youth, because he was, in terms of everyday democracy, was extraordinarily inspirational. Little did I imagine, looking back to the late 1960s and the early 70s, and during the rest of the 70s, in which I had my civic awakening as a very young teenager, that I would find myself in the 21st century being charged with espionage as an American. Because growing up in Vermont, guess what other history we were exposed to? Benedict Arnold. Benedict Arnold was considered to be the exemplar traitor. He was very close to General Washington. He knew the command structure. And he went to the other side. I was never a Benedict Arnold. The only spying I ever did was on behalf of the American people. And the only oath that I took that mattered was the oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States of America. An oath given the title of this topic, and yes, I will get to NSA, given the title of this topic, was an oath to support and defend that Constitution. I had done so 4 times in my career. Air Force, as an enlisted air crew member flying in RC-135s during the latter years of the Cold War, listening in on the communications of the Warsaw Pact, and the country in which I became an expert was East Germany, a fascist surveillance state. I was a cryptolinguist. I had to learn enough German to understand what I was listening to, and even a little bit of Russian thrown in. I was an electronic warfare mission crew supervisor, different application of my technical skills. I was a reserve intel officer in the Navy. That's when I took the oath again. I worked at the CIA as an image analyst. That was another time I took the oath. And then in 2001, having a pretty good career in industry, both with the government as well as doing a lot of consulting in Silicon Valley and elsewhere during the go-go 90s, I answered an ad in the Washington Post and became a senior executive at the National Security Agency. Who hasn't heard of the NSA? About 15 miles south of here is a very interesting facility. I will say more about that. But that represents the power of an extraordinarily secret agency in your own backyard. And I recognize there was a lot of political forces and approvals that led to the Utah Data Center constructed in Bluffdale. But there is a fundamental question. What is it doing in your backyard, and what is its purpose? Not too many of you talk about that facility. I was well aware of the planning for that while I was at NSA. They were looking for a place in the United States that was relatively secure, had enough infrastructure to support it, had the political backing to make it happen, where they could create a storage facility. If you literally take the name of the facility that they've acknowledged is the name, that means there's data inside there. The question is, what kind of data? Well, but I digress slightly. See, my first day in the job was 9/11. That's the day after I'd taken the oath, had gone through in-processing, had signed all the forms, had gotten my government security clearance. I did have a security clearance as a contractor. The first day that I reported was that morning, and it was it wasn't literally O-Dark 30, although that's a whole story in itself in terms of when I went through SEER training, was waterboarded and went through enhanced interrogation techniques to understand what it would be like if I ever found myself in the wrong country being tortured. But I'm not here to talk about that. But you are looking at somebody, by the way, who is the only person who's been investigated, prosecuted, indicted, and convicted for surveillance. the very surveillance that the facility 15 miles south of here engages in terms of the data from that surveillance and the processing of that data. I'm the only person, and I had nothing to do with surveillance. Why would the government come after me in such an egregious manner and charge me with espionage? There's a much larger story here, and it strikes at the heart of who we are. It strikes at the very heart of what makes America. It strikes at the very foundations of our country, because if I take you back just briefly, you'll find myself jumping back and forth, because we sometimes, or we have often forgotten our own history, the very beginnings of our country. This country was born in violent revolution. We were the terrorists and the traitors of the day. It was a very small percentage of the population. Roughly 3% of the population was even actively involved in the revolution against the crown. And why did we separate from the crown? All you have to do is read the Declaration of Independence, and you'll know why. All those usurpations of power. And as more than a passing student of history and politics, it's important to point out, which were later enumerated and codified as fundamental rights in the Bill of Rights, are the First and Fourth Amendments. I could easily make the argument that if it wasn't for the usurpations of the very things protected in the First and Fourth Amendments, we would not be the United States of America. And the Founding Fathers, for all their faults and foibles, well knew what the risks were. And there were no guarantees. And they had just had the abysmal failure of the Articles of Confederation. And King George and the Crown weren't too happy about those obstreperous colonialists winning the great power of, you know, of the seas and the empire of Great Britain. And so that our young nation had to find a way to create a governance structure that would take into account the need for enough power, but not too much. And the one critical thing was never give the executive too much power. They did not want a mechanism that would allow the equivalent of an executive monarchy to arise within this country. But there were no guarantees given the nature of human history and those who like to rule over others in a rather unequal relationship. 9/11 was my first day on the job. I took an oath. The only oath that mattered. None of the other things I signed, even the non-disclosure agreements, took primacy over the oath. That oath was to an idea and how to govern ourselves. That oath, to me, was inviolate. That oath was everything. And that oath was to support and defend the Constitution against who? All enemies, foreign and domestic. And I would not break faith with that oath. Period. So 9/11 happens. So it's important to say here again before you, and I stand before you as a free human being, after having faced many, many decades in prison, and one of the few under the Obama administration who managed to hold them off so I could actually be here free to talk about it all. I'm very fortunate. John Kiriakou, the only other American, right? The only American, they say the only other. There's only two people, right? That were charged, prosecuted, charged, indicted, and convicted for torture and surveillance. He's the other American, the only American who ended up being prosecuted for torture, but he didn't torture. He's in a prison right now in Loretto, Pennsylvania, because he blew the whistle. He acknowledged it was state-sponsored torture and disclosed the name of a torturer, which, interestingly enough, was never actually made public. So I'm very fortunate, okay? So it's 9/11. 9/11 was a systemic failure of the U.S. government to protect the nation, period. Fundamental failure. And yet what was set into motion, because the government is too big to fail, were a series of strategic decisions made in the deepest of secrecy. And I had to confront the Pandora's box of one of those critical decisions, as well as a number of others that were made in those short few weeks and months after 9/11. Why was 9/11 a systemic failure? Because the government's primary responsibility, two of them, read the preamble of the Constitution, is to provide for the common defense and the general welfare. The government had utterly failed to provide for the common defense. Utterly failed. Now, that's an irony in terms of U.S. history, because we had World War II, which some refer to as the last great war, the last good war. I guess things were pretty clear back then as to what was at stake. And we formed, under the National Security Act of 1947, a whole series of national defense agencies and departments, so we would never, ever have to have a Pearl Harbor again. We would never, ever have to be surprised again. Yet 9/11 happened. Systemic failure. So the workforce, because I worked for the number three person at the time, took this extraordinarily hard. They realized that NSA was also culpable in failing to keep people out of harm's way. But not so on the part of leadership, from General Michael V. Hayden on down. And General Michael Hayden is central to understanding the dark side of this history. Central. I used to be in executive session with him on many, many occasions. It was extraordinary when I look back on the things he used to say, okay, regarding 9/11. He has a lot to cover up for. And here's why. Because the government was too big to fail, and although they had fundamentally failed the nation, as well as others, to keep people out of harm's way, 9/11 was a trigger event to unchain the government from the Constitution in the deepest of secrecy. And the only other way for me to describe it in the starkest of the English language is a government willfully chose, as an act of commission, to subvert the Constitution, and they did so all the way to the top from the White House. Now, how can I say that? There's a lot I can say, but I'm going to summarize. What I discovered in the short few weeks after 9/11 was that with the approval of the White House, the extraordinary power of NSA was literally turned on the United States of America. No different than how it treated other nations. The full power. People also forget our history. So now I'm going to take you back to the 70s. Remember that period in which I had my civic awakening? That's the period of the Pentagon Papers. Daniel Ellsberg, who I was on a panel at the USC Annenberg Center just the other day with Jesselyn Radack. Three whistleblowers who happened to remain free, who did not end up in prison, right? That's rare these days when you're charged or threatened with criminal prosecution. So Pentagon Papers, Watergate, a president of the United States resigning his office. And I remember, which came out in the David Frost, those extraordinary David Frost interviews, well, if the president does it, it's legal. So I'm going to go back to 3 weeks after 9/11. I'm discovering what is happening. I'm discovering that the NSA is using extraordinary surveillance power and turning it on the United States, and either taking existing relationships with telcos and internet service providers or creating expanded relationships in the deepest of secrecy. And I confronted, first week of October 2001, not knowing at the time that the President Bush had already signed, it was a couple days earlier as it turns out, October 4th, had already signed a secret directive, which is still secret to this day, authorizing NSA to take the extraordinary surveillance powers and turn them on the U.S., starting with just about every phone number that existed. Not literally every phone number, but with the major telcos, at least Verizon, based on Snowden disclosures. But I was there earlier on when these programs were first put into place. starting with phone numbers. That was only the beginning. The full disclosure, the full set of all of those activities has yet to be fully disclosed. It wasn't just phone numbers. And it wasn't just metadata. It started with that. It led to a whole lot of other mass surveillance of other communications. So it's the first week of October. I confront the lead attorney at NSA. He's denied, he can't deny the conversation took place. He just says that's not how he remembers it. Very convenient. Very convenient because the person who I reported to, the number three person at NSA who led the Signals Intelligence Directorate, was the one who actually said, go talk to this attorney in the Office of General Counsel. Right? So there's are other people who are well aware that the conversation took place. There's also two 9/11 congressional investigations in which I shared the nature and both summary and the details of that conversation. Although all that apparently got censored and suppressed, right? Because it was too secret, even as a state secret, to end up in the final reports. That's a whole other story, okay? So I'm having this confrontation with the lead attorney. And I pause because every time I say what he shared with me, the hair goes up on the back of my neck. And this is why. Remember the period in which I had my civic awakening. Remember what President Nixon said. Knowing President Nixon resigned office and as a very young teenager, having watched the impeachment committee form those articles of impeachment against the President of the United States, it was extraordinary. And he resigned his office. Go back and read those articles. You'll find out the president was abusing instruments of the government against Americans. So, he said, you don't understand, Mr. Drake. It's all legal. The White House has approved the program. They always called it the program. The actual name of the foundational secret mass surveillance programs was actually known as Stellar Wind, which was an umbrella name in itself. Don't ask any more questions. We are the executive agent for this program. And I said, I paused, I said, we're in violation of the Constitution. Last time I checked, there's a Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. The exclusive means by which you can conduct this type of activity, and you have to have a warrant, although there was hot pursuit, but you still have to go back to the secret court for the warrant. Oh, now go back to 1978. FISA was the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act passed in 1978 under President Carter. Why? Because of severe abuses by instruments of national power during the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Programs like Operation Shamrock, a mass surveillance program all by itself in the deepest secrecy, wasn't even revealed until 1975 during the Church Committee hearings. In fact, Church Committee staffers that still are around have called for a new Church Committee. We've been here before, except what I was now confronted with, the stark reality of my own government unchaining itself from the Constitution, as if it no longer mattered. And I said, why? He said, you don't understand. We live in exigent conditions. Look up the word exigent. It's a very interesting word, exigent. It requires extraordinary means to deal with the reality. We were attacked. Yes, we were. But does that mean we unchain ourselves from the very form of government that we formed now over 225 years ago? Apparently so. I said, well, wait a minute. The last time I checked, there's a constitutional means in this country. If the existing law is insufficient, you go back to Congress and you make the case. This is 9/11. Congress would have signed off on just about anything, but apparently not the mass surveillance programs. Because when I brought that to his attention, he said, they would say no. They will say no. The rest of my hair standing up. Because what he was asking for was turning the United States of America into the equivalent of a foreign nation for the purposes of electronic dragnet surveillance on an extraordinarily vast scale, making the 1970s and all the surveillance and the violations of the Constitution then look incredibly mild, even juvenile by comparison. We just need the data, Mr. Drake. You don't understand. We have threats to discover. So I'm now faced with a stark reality. I'm faced with a stark reality of having taken an oath to support and defend the Constitution. My father having served in World War II. What is this all about? Do I just look the other way? I didn't make the decisions. Or do I use the German Nazi-era excuse during the Nuremberg trials? We were just following orders. See, if I'd actually engaged in surveillance, I never would have faced espionage. If John Kiriakou had actually tortured, he would have immunity. So what do I do? Remember, I've been in the military. You don't have to follow unlawful orders. This is an unlawful program. It violates the Fourth Amendment of the United States of America. I take an oath to defend that Constitution. What do you do? I work at the Never Say Anything agency. And if you say anything that's unauthorized outside of channels, guess what? You might invite attention. And so I became a material witness, just in summary, with two 9/11 congressional investigations in 2002. All of that evidence, material evidence, both oral, okay, verbal, as well as many, many pages of material documentation, running into the thousands if you count up all the electronic and hard copy, was all censored, suppressed. Do you know the only record today that exists regarding my material witness whistleblowing and testimony with the formal investigators of those two 9/11 investigations looking to why 9/11 had happened was the fact that I was interviewed? No other evidence apparently exists. This is how secret this state's secret was. Incredibly secret. A couple years go by, I was part of a Department of Defense Inspector General audit investigation looking at a couple of programs, one of them involving Thin Thread. I gave material witness about what NSA actually knew but had not shared with in channels in terms of indications and warning. We're talking Al-Qaeda and associative movement. One of the interesting things about my own history is I used to sit as a reserve intel officer in the Navy at the Pentagon in the Alert Center, National Military Joint Intelligence Center. And though I don't often say this, I will here just to give you some additional context. Where was I in 1993? Notice I'm going back and forth here in terms of history. We've been here before. Gee, the World Trade Center shot, they tried to drop them the first time with truck bombs. I was sitting on the terrorism desk. That's where I learned about Al-Qaeda and associated movements. And we said then they're coming back. But the then chief military intelligence officer who headed up the J-2 reporting to the Joint Chiefs of Staff actually came down to the alert center and said, yeah, I've seen your reports, but who cares about some raghead spouting off fatwas in the desert? Then 9/11 happened. Could have been prevented. But as General Hayden said during the executive session, when the 9/11 commission was spinning up, he said, how nice is it to hide in the shadows of the FBI and the CIA and let them take all the heat for 9/11? NSA had significant culpability. And it's been discussed, I've talked about it publicly. They had the numbers from the Yemeni safe house, the switchboard, okay? They had them, all right? Anything else you've heard is a flat-out lie. I provided all the evidence, actual evidence, that backed all it up with the 9/11 congressional investigations. Again, all suppressed and censored. And then there's multi-billion dollar fraud. See, after 9/11, in those first few days after 9/11, the workforce took it incredibly hard. I went around with the director of Signals Intelligence in an attempt to console the workforce and explain what happened and how we were going to respond. And she said a very unfortunate statement that 9/11 was a gift to NSA, we're going to get all the money we want and then some. Wow. So I live with incredibly dark knowledge. And I decided to stand up. And I can even feel it right now, re-relating to you precisely where I found myself. I just happened to be an eyewitness to extraordinarily dark side history. See, then Vice President Cheney was right 5 days after 9/11. He said, we're going to go to the dark side. He said this on broadcast television. I don't think people fully appreciated then what he meant by going to the dark side. See, in times of crisis, it is true in terms of our own history. Your own form of government comes under extreme pressure. There is temptation to bypass law, bypass, in this case, the Constitution, to deal with perceived or actual threats. I recognize 9/11 actually happened. I'm here to tell you that it could have been prevented, but it happened. So that's too late. It's now 2005. I wrote a letter to then director, because he's now retired, that's not too long ago, to then director Keith Alexander in November 2005. He had just become the NSA director in August. I wrote a letter to him, and I ended up losing my job at NSA. I was reorganized. I ended up at the National Defense University. It was pretty clear the handwriting was on the wall. Severe retaliation. Severe. It actually had taken place in the previous 3 years, plus three and a half, the preceding 3.5 years. But that's a longer part of the story. So what do you do? It's now 2005, and now it's December of 2005, and guess what I'm reading on the front page above the fold of the New York Times? An incredible article revealing for the first time publicly the existence of the so-called terror surveillance program, the warrantless wiretapping program, an article written by Eric Lichtblau and James Risen. And I knew when that was published in the middle of December of 2005 that I would, and then 2 weeks later when the Department of Justice announced a massive national security leak investigation to find the sources for the article, I knew I would get caught up in that investigation. It was not a question of if, it was just simply a matter of when. Why? The set of people that knew about Stellar Wind, that knew about the secret surveillance programs, were extraordinarily small. That's how secret this was. Most people were not read in. For those who have had security clearances, and I had security clearances for many, many years, there are things called compartmented intelligence. And this was in a very special compartment. So there was very few people read in, as they say, into that program. And the military was like a special access program. So very few people actually knew about it. And so the universe of those who would have knowledge, like I did, about Stellar Wind, about Thin Thread, and other related programs, were in a very small subset of the much larger NSA population, which is in the tens of thousands. Most people at NSA had no knowledge this was ongoing. It was truly a dark, dark program, even at NSA. And it's already an agency that already has a top secret plus clearance just to even work there in just about anything, as a minimum. So with great fanfare, they launch this investigation. And I pause, because now I'm faced in the Constitution of the United States. Do I exercise my First Amendment rights, part of the title of this talk, do I exercise my First Amendment rights and go to the press with what I know? I was certainly aware of history. I was certainly aware of what had happened to Daniel Ellsberg. And he had gone to trial. I made a fateful decision in February of 2006 to contact a reporter from the Baltimore Sun anonymously. With what I knew about the secret surveillance programs, with what I knew about the massive multi-billion dollar fraud, waste, and abuse, which was extraordinarily extensive and far-reaching, and what I knew about the intel failure of 9/11 and the cover-up. And I had anonymous contact with that reporter for about a year before I ultimately made a choice to meet. Now, I'm going to accelerate the rest of what happened to me so we can actually, I can actually have some Q&A with you. Because I told you I'm the only person that was prosecuted, indicted, and convicted for surveillance and had nothing to do with surveillance. I simply chose to blow the whistle on it, and that's why I was charged. So imagine you're in your home, and you're getting ready to go down to work. In this case, I was teaching strategic leadership, leadership ethics, and information strategies at the Industrial College of the Armed Forces at Fort McNair in D.C., the National Defense University. It's the highest level of education within the government military system. I've been there. I was on my second year. I was also, ironically enough, teaching a course on the secret side of U.S. history, from the American Revolutionary War to the present day. And that included George Washington as the original spy master. Extraordinary history, even in terms of the American Revolution. My last official act as a senior executive of the government was taking my class to, guess where? The International Spy Museum in D.C. How many of you have been to the International Spy Museum? It is a popular place to go to. A lot of cool stuff there. There's stuff in there that I used to do or was associated with, okay? Particularly in terms of the Cold War and a lot of the technology. Remember, I used to work at the CIA. I remember when we checked in, it was a special arrangement with one of the curators of the museum. It was like basically a personal private tour, not the normal public tour. They had a little card that was highlighting NSA, but they had gotten the date of its creation wrong. I remember filling out a card saying the real date of its creation, right, is 1952. Next morning, just imagine you're me and you're looking out of your bedroom window and you see a dozen FBI agents streaming across the front yard. And the nightmare had begun. See, 4 months earlier, my colleagues had been raided, former NSA employees. And the professional staffer who used to be on the House Intel Committee who had the NSA account were all raided, West Coast and East Coast. I knew I was next. I cooperated with the FBI for 5 months. In April of 2008, the chief prosecutor at the time looked at me and he said, "Mr. Drake, how would you like to spend the rest of your life in prison unless you cooperate with our investigation?" I broke off. I said, "I will not plead bargain with the truth." I broke off all cooperation. I hired a private attorney at well over $500 an hour. And even though I was a senior executive making over $150,000 a year and had other assets given where I used to work in industry, over the next 2 years, I essentially liquidated all of my cash assets or what I could convert. In March of 2010, under the Obama administration, Bush had never done this. Yes, there's Valerie Plame, but that was a leak. Okay, that wasn't whistleblowing. That was for political purposes, to severe embarrassment, paybacks to her husband, Joseph Wilson, the ambassador. And of course, I used to work at the CIA, and the most egregious thing you can do is your own government doing it, is reveal the identity of a non-official cover agent, the most sensitive type of agent in operations, now the National Clandestine Service, that exists at the CIA. Another story. I was charged in secret at an FBI facility in the greater D.C. area by the then chief prosecutor, William Welsh, used to head up the Office of Public Integrity in the Department of Justice. He's working under the supervision of Lanny Brewer, who used to head up the criminal division, reports directly to Attorney General Holder. I've had some interesting encounters with Attorney General Holder, one in particular. 3 weeks later, in a very public way, they file a formal indictment on me, signed by, approved by General Holder, charging me 10 felony count indictment, 5 counts of espionage, 1 for obstruction of justice, and 4 for making false statements to FBI officials, agents. By the way, I was such a threat to the national security of the United States that they had actually taken agents, FBI agents, from their mole hunter unit to find out everything they could about me. In fact, the New York Times published an article in the summer of 2010 detailing 5 full-time prosecutors had been put on the case and 25 full-time agents. At the time they came to my door, my son opened up the door. He had the presence of mind as a 12-year-old to say, there's someone here to see you, Dad. So it's now April of 2010. I've been indicted. I'm facing 35 years in prison if I was found guilty on all counts. The next 14 months, I had to defend everything I had taken an oath to defend and support. I had become criminalized. I was now a criminal defendant. I was declared indigent before the court. I had no money left. No other attorney would support me or defend me. Fortunately, I had very good public defenders. There were the Maryland federal public defenders. I had to find a way to influence the court of public opinion. Jesselyn Radack of the Government Accountability Project, their director of national security and human rights, wrote this extraordinary op-ed in the LA Times. I realized when I read that, and it turns out she'd been a whistleblower herself in the Department of Justice in the so-called American Taliban John Walker Lynn case, where as a U.S. citizen, his representative rights for legal counsel were violated. She ended up defending me in the court of public opinion. Long story short, I was able to hold them off, did not end up in prison. I did plead out to, they dropped all charges, and I pled out to a minor misdemeanor for doing what? Exceeding the authorized use of a government computer under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. But I was free. 1 year probation, pro forma sentencing, 240 hours of community service. The silver lining is I got to interview veterans from World War II to the present day, including veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan. I've served with many honorable servicemen and women. I've served with many honorable people in the government. But here I was, having been criminalized for having supported and defended the Constitution. Who's the betrayer now? I just want to share, for me it's very poignant, these interviews, you can go, it was for the Library of Congress, the Veterans History Project. Go out to their site, and do a search on the interviewer, and just put in Thomas Drake, and there's almost 40 interviews. Without exception, but particularly from the World War II veterans who are passing away in very large numbers now. You know, they're in their late 80s and 90s. Others have been gone for a long time. I'm talking about the ones that were the youngest that joined. My father served in World War II, actually supported the OSS as an aircrew member. Without exception, the World War II veterans, but even others, but particularly the World War II veterans, kept saying, "What has become of our country? What has become of our country? Do we give up the fundamental ideals that form this nation? For what?" It's quite interesting when you have veterans asking those hard questions. You see, if our individual rights, our individual freedoms don't matter, then what do we become? Just today it's come out. Anybody fly in Wi-Fi? You know, Wi-Fi that's provided in a lot of U.S. domestic flights? Well, guess what? Turns out they're turning over their data to NSA. Why? Is it necessary to collect everything there is to know about everybody just as an insurance policy? Do we really want citizens turning into subjects of the state again? I don't think so. So I'll leave you this and open up for Q&A. I'm going to go back to 1787. And I haven't been on James Madison's estate where he sat there that long winter of 1786 looking across out west to the Blue Ridge, imagining the Constitution. How do we best govern ourselves? So in 1787, in the deepest of secrecy, the Constitutional Convention took place. At the end of the convention, history records when Franklin was approached by a woman reporter and asked, and I'm paraphrasing, I wasn't there, what did you guys create in there? Franklin is purported to have responded with the following: a republic, if you can keep it. Our constitutional republic is a very special form of a democracy. I believe that grand experiment is still worth keeping. So the question we have to ask ourselves together as we the people, in order to form a more perfect union, is what future do we want to keep? Because that's what's at stake. Thanks for listening.
We now have some time for questions. Please state your full name and wait for the mic if you have one.
My name is Kevin Wong. I'm a political science major here at the U. And I just have an overall question, if you could answer it.
Sure.
I think back in September of last year, the NSA admitted to having workers use these monitoring programs for personal use, in the sense of like spying on ex-wives or people like that. Are there any preventative measures that the NSA is taking to prevent that from happening, or even to the extent of doing their own personal quote unquote spying?
The temptations are enormous, and I think NSA in some ways have been trying to hide the larger formal surveillance programs by simply pointing out people that kind of abuse their privilege. It's an absolute violation. Interesting enough, when NSA is asked about Americans being spied on in terms of surveillance programs, they say it would violate the privacy rights of Americans for us to tell you that, which, how hypocritical. So you violate their rights, but you can't tell them how many have been violated because it'd be a violation of their privacy rights to actually know about the violations. Figure that logic out. Yes, there have been clearly, I was aware even when I was there. See, I was under a 23 legal regime, right, from the time when I was served in the government. That 23 legal regime was the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Because of all those abuses prior to that act, that was the mechanism, the exclusive mechanism of criminal sanctions that all NSA employees and affiliates, including military, that were assigned, had to follow. It was absolute. It was the prime directive. Some would say it was the first commandment of NSA. There was very specific procedures. When I was overseas, for example, if I ended up even inadvertently acquiring communications of a U.S. person defined as a U.S. citizen, resident legal alien, or U.S. corporation, we had special minimization procedures. If you had to process the intelligence, it may have been there, not the U.S. communications, but the other intelligence, then you had to expunge the tapes. I had special procedures for that. There was criminal sanctions if you violated, under U.S. code, Title 18, it's the criminal code. What were those sanctions? $10,000 fine for every instance of violation, 5 years in prison. Okay? So, yes, were there people? And yes. Now, people have asked what happened to them, were they fired? Don't know. A lot of this is still obscured. Are there means or mechanisms by which NSA or the monitor? Yeah, it's I left in 2007. I ended up resigning in 2008. Even then, when you signed onto a computer, there was a little thing that would pop up about you're always subject to monitoring, right? That monitoring has become, let's just say, a little bit more intense, and particularly since the Snowden disclosures, in particular. So yes, again, it's a violation. Of FISA, right? It's a violation of the Constitution for someone employed by NSA to be listening in on U.S. persons, but the temptations are great. The temptations are extraordinarily great because the amount of data that's being collected. And, you know, what are the controls on that? Now, this is separate from the fact that they're even collecting it, because NSA has actually made an interesting argument, which is, if you go into, look at the books in the library here, okay, on the bookshelf. Well, the fact that there's books on the shelf, okay, let's say NSA put it there, that doesn't mean that it's in violation. It's not until we take the book off the shelf and actually open it up and start reading it that that's when it becomes a violation. Actually, it's the collection is the violation. So that's subverted even the original threshold standards for the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. There's been, even before its known disclosures, James Bamford there was a special with James Bamford in which he actually had analysts from Fort Gordon in Georgia, one of the NSA Georgia, where they actually acknowledged listening in on the communications of loved ones. I say loved ones. They were ordered to do so from overseas. What does that tell you? Right. Those are just individual examples. Right. What I was exposed to and what metastasized over the intervening 12 years is something far more pernicious, far more extraordinary, where essentially internet and the other nets have become the greatest surveillance platform in history. And although the United States did not invent surveillance, or even a surveillance regime or a surveillance state, they've certainly taken to a whole new level. And this is an opportunity for me to say this. I believe that the conduct of NSA, obviously approved by the president, okay, represents one of the most single, direct, and compelling threats to democracy today, period. I've asked for the dissolution, the dismantling of NSA as it currently exists, because I don't personally think that NSA as an institution can actually truly be reformed. It's just too far gone. Now, that's just NSA. Look, you have to remember one thing, and it is probably important in terms of the subject, the title of this talk, and I didn't say it earlier, but I'm just going to say this really quickly. Unlike any other, you name me, any other government agency or department that was created as an act of Congress signed into law by the president, NSA was literally created by the stroke of a pen in 1952. It's a military organization headed by a general. The justification post 9/11, I can make an argument that for 60% of NSA's existence has been violating the law willfully and purposefully and deliberatively. There's only that 23-year period in which it wasn't. Right, I say 23 years, period, okay, which it wasn't, right, in quotes. So what does that say? That says we're militarizing this space. You get into comitatus, you get into the dynamics of the commander-in-chief's responsibility under Article 2, this is what's happening. You get into the John Yoo justification of the Bush administration, the unitary executive theory, that he has all the power he needs and then some, that he's justified, really. So executive rule trumps the Constitution. But you're using the commander-in-chief role as your backdoor. I don't think so. Okay. Next question. Posse comitatus. Yeah. I'm slightly dyslexic.
Hans Erber, Economics Department. I want to play a little bit devil's advocate and channel Obama. Obama knows that. The environmental crisis is really serious. He tries to prevent the crisis from happening. He realizes that he cannot do it, even as a president of the United States, against the powers of industry. What is the next best thing he can do? He knows that when the crisis breaks out, there will be widespread unrest, not just from the people who we know, are oppositional, but from everybody. So he is deciding to select indiscriminately information about everyone so that if there is this chaos, that the U.S. government can survive and can maintain order.
Yeah, I actually have greater faith in the American people than I do in the President of the United States. Having said that, And there is a thing called, the Second Amendment. It's the one amendment most Americans remember or know. The truth is, when you subvert the Constitution, and I said the government unchained itself, we've been operating under emergency powers, the government in secret, for quite some time. And that has essentially given the government the license to do precisely that. And let's not kid ourselves. They've interviewed former Stasi officers. This from a regime that I used to listen in on. Okay, they said it's naive to believe that when you collect this kind of information, that it'll not be used for other purposes. The bottom line is, or if Hannah Arendt, right, his totalitarianism book. It's really about social control, monitoring people. That's what it's about. And so this kind of information lets you do that. It's one of the other dark sides of a mass surveillance regime. And it cannot, it's anathema, it's an alien form of government, even if it's secret. It cannot coexist with a constitutional republic. Something has to give. So what stands in the way of that type of mindset is the Constitution. He's in violation of his own oath. He has a special oath that's actually written into the Constitution. He has to preserve and protect. Okay. He has to preserve, protect. Right. All I have to do is support and defend. They added that for the president. Preserve and protect. Wow. He's not right. And somehow, if you listen to the Daily Show with Jon Stewart, this was a few months ago, he spoke about this legal framework. The last time I checked, the only legal framework he is obligated to honor and follow is the Constitution of the United States. There is no other legal framework. So, next question.
Well, unfortunately, that is all the time we have for questions. Please join me in thanking Thomas Drake for another insightful forum.